August 5th, 2020. I'm Steve Boder.
I'm Chip Essenflow.
And I'm Pam Vidor.
And we have arrived at the last chapter, plus a little epilogue, of the Valley of Fear, the last Sherlock Holmes novel written by Arthur Conan Doyle.
This is a little bit of a sad moment for us. I have had much fun reading these stories with you guys. It's over.
I love this. This has been lots of fun.
This has been great. This has been something to look forward to every morning for 122 mornings. We have had this discussion reading through the entire canon, every word that Arthur Conan Doyle ever wrote about Sherlock Holmes.
So is this the point where we go ahead and just inform all of our listeners to thanking them, one, thank you for joining us, and then second, that the COVID is over, that they can go out and do whatever they need to do.
We're definitely not going back into a national lockdown, so it's all good. I say let's turn back to 1875 instead of pursuing that line of inquiry, Chip. What do you guys think?
I was just looking forward to telling our listeners about our, I was thinking about all the cruise ship that we're all going to join and spend time on, and we can discuss all the Conan Doyle, Sherlock Holmes.
The Sherlock Holmes cruise, yes. I would love that. Let's cure COVID. Let's get rid of this COVID by ending this conversation. Then we can go on the Sherlock Holmes cruise. But today, let's get to Chapter 7, The Trapping of Bertie Edwards. This is the climax of this story, Pam.
It sure is. And it opens like a climax. As McMurdo had said, the house in which he lived was a lonely one and very well suited for such a crime as they had planned. It was on the extreme fringe of town and stood well back from the road. In any other case, the conspirators would have simply called out their man, as they had many a time before, and emptied their pistols into his body. But in this instance, it was very necessary to find out how much he knew, how he knew it, and what had been passed on to his employers. So we're setting this up very much like the great reveal scene in a Sherlock Holmes detective story, having the detective come to this abandoned house, and we're going to have a big talk before killing this guy.
Big talk. That sounds exciting.
Big talk. That this is Arthur Conan Doyle. That's how Sherlock solves crimes, is with big talk. These people would just go to where he was, shoot him, and walk away.
This is an intervention, and we're going to stop this now.
This is big talk, for sure. We get a reminder about Bodymaster's power here.
I love the description. I mean, McGinty is always described as larger than life, right? The giant was in his shirt sleeves, with chains and seals gleaming athwart his ample waistcoat, and a diamond twinkling through the fringe of his bristling beard. Drink and politics had made the boss a very rich as well as powerful man. The more terrible, therefore, seemed that glimpse of the prison or the gallows which had risen before him the night before. So we're really reminded that McGinty's at the height of his power. He likes to wear accoutrements to actually show people his wealth. And he's terrified of getting caught by a detective because he's got his life mapped out. And so McGinty suspects that Brother Morris may be an informant, and he suggests to McMurdo that maybe they better either beat up or even kill Brother Morris. And McMurdo's like, sure, we'll do that, but let's not do it today. We can't afford to set the police buzzing today of all days. We got to wait until after we get this Pinkerton under wraps.
And this conversation, yes, McGinty shows emotion here. He is afraid of what's going to happen. And McMurdo is very powerful in his ability to soothe McGinty's nerves at this point. This has been 3 months. Is that what we find out in this chapter? That this has been 3 months of a relationship that McMurdo has been cultivating with this group?
Well, when you say soothe their nerves, Steve, was that when they brought out the bottle of whiskey?
There is some whiskey that goes on later on. That is for sure.
We'll get there, Chip. Don't worry.
That's right.
But McMurdo is putting together this this whole idea of what they're going to do. He is the mastermind that is going to keep the group going in the midst of this invasion by this birdie person.
Right. And we're in his house. And so he sets it up. And so we actually get the preparation of the scene described. When he had returned home, he made his own preparations for the grim evening in front of him. First, he cleaned, oiled, and loaded his Smith & Wesson revolver. Then he surveyed the room in which the detective was to be trapped. It was a large apartment with a long deal table in the center and the big stove at one side. At each of the other sides were windows. There were no shutters on these, only light curtains which drew across. McMurdo examined these attentively. No doubt it must have struck him that the apartment was very exposed for so secret a meeting, yet its distance from the road made it of less consequence. Finally, he discussed the matter with his fellow lodger. Scanlan, though a scourer, was an inoffensive little man who was too weak to stand against the opinion of his comrades, but was secretly horrified by the deeds of blood at which he had sometimes been forced to assist. McMurdo told him shortly what was intended. And if I were you, Mike Scanlan, I would take a night off and keep clear of it. There will be bloody work here before morning. Well, indeed then, Mac, Scanlan answered. I think it's a lot of really interesting things here. This idea that Mike Scanlan is a scourer. He's the very first one we met on the train. But he's not completely into it.
Mm-hmm.
There's this suggestion, like, you kind of wonder how many of the members of this secret society are just following the pack and actually disgusted or revolted, secretly horrified, as he says here, by the criminal element in which they have found themselves.
Between Morris and Scanlan, we've got at least two examples of that, and that sample must mean that there are others.
And, you know, think about all the prep work that has gone into setting this trap. And then you're going to turn to Scanlan and say, maybe you'll want to take the night off. There could be some blood work. Listen, Scanlan may be one of the, better people in the area. Uh-huh. Still, all he has to do is say something to someone and all that prep goes away.
Yes, the secret part of this secret society is very tenuous here, and that's what they're trying to protect. They're trying to protect the secrecy.
Well, I'm thinking more along the lines of McMurdo giving away the plan.
Mm-hmm.
His particular plan.
But he knows Scanlan, right? They've been roommates for all this time. They've been living together in this boarding house, and he knows Scanlan's not going to say anything. You know, Scanlan's too weak.
Okay.
The secret society, the very tight-knit society, the full of secrets, everybody's got a skeleton in their closet, literally, and they protect each other. This is brother to brother. I think you should go be somewhere else tonight.
Yeah, you don't think there could be some play with McGinty if he knew about this? He's part of the secret society, too.
Yes, I think that if McGinty knew that McMurdo was protecting anyone from danger, that there might be repercussions there, for sure.
And I guess I think it's a really interesting and fairly nuanced representation of this kind of criminal situation. So as we've talked about before, this is really an examination of organized crime. And this notion that some sort of lower level members in organized criminal organizations might not really, they might just be there by circumstance and not be totally committed to the mission of their organization. I think that's probably fairly true. I mean, it's true in gangs as well as in various organized criminal.
Well, wouldn't we call that like Vegas, Las Vegas, set up, these were criminal organizations, many of them who set up the original houses. But anyway, that was organized crime above it. But the people who were working there, I mean, these were all just regular jobs.
It's just a job. Yeah.
And so I do think there's a sort of investigation of that. And it's interesting that it's in this American novel by Doyle, because this isn't something we've really seen Sherlock Holmes look into in the other 59 stories we've read. I also think it's interesting that Scanlan here calls McMurdo Mac, which is the same nickname that Inspector McDonald from the Holmes and Watson portion of the book. So there's a lot of mix in this.
We should blame the editor. We'll blame the editor.
No, I think she's right. I think that this is a two halves thing. This is the mirror of part one. This guy's nickname is Mac, and here's part two, and we have another character whose nickname is Mac. Just like we have the in the first part, this criminal mastermind who's behind all of this, and here we have another criminal organization with a leader who is in charge of all this. That's good writing, I think. There's all this bureaucracy and organization, all these meetings, all these committees, but boy, Chip, these outlaws do drink, don't they?
Well, that's why there's whiskeys, Steve. Have a few whiskeys. It'll calm your nerves, make your reflexes a little slower. We got something planned for you later on.
It'll calm you down a little bit. They're jittery. They're jittery. They're not going to serve them coffee. That would be bad. The Committee of Seven go to McMurdo's to await Bertie Edwards. Their host had placed whiskey upon the table, and they had hastened to prime themselves for the work before them. Baldwin and Cormac were already half drunk, and the liquor had brought out all of their ferocity. There you go. That, again, back to that, alcoholism leads to ferocity in Doyle's mind, not to leisure.
McMurdo doesn't drink. He stays cool and collected, and everyone's like, oh, thank goodness McMurdo's got this covered.
Well, he's got to have nerves of steel because, I mean, his plan is coming to a head right now. Mm-hmm. There's a lot going on. There's a lot that could go wrong if this goes wrong.
Uh-huh. There's a knock at the door. The seven committee members are in the dark waiting to ambush this Bertie character, and the wait seems interminable.
So McMurdo came to the end of the table and looked round at them. A subtle change had come over him. His manner was of one who has great work to do. His face had set into granite firmness. His eyes shone with a fierce excitement behind his spectacles. He had become visible leader of men. They stared at him with eager interest, but he said nothing. Still, with the same singular gaze, he looked from man to man. "Well," cried Boss McGinty at last, "is he here? Is Bertie Edwards here?" "Yes," McMurdo answered slowly. "Bertie Edwards is here. I am Bertie Edwards."
Da, da, da.
But no one said that because there were 10 seconds after that brief speech, during which the room might have been empty, so profound was the silence. The hissing of a kettle upon the stove rose sharp and strident to the ear. 7 white faces, all turned upward to this man who dominated them, were set motionless with utter terror. Then, with a sudden shivering of glass, a bristle of glistening rifle barrels broke through each window while the curtains were torn from their hangings. At the sight, Boss McGinty gave the roar of a wounded bear and plunged for the half-open door. A leveled revolver met him there with the stern blue eyes of Captain Marvin of the Mine Police gleaming behind the sights. The boss recoiled and fell back into his chair. Woo! So that's it, guys. This is the climax. So not only do we get the great reveal that McMurdo has been the Pinkerton detective all along, but glass starts breaking, windows are broken through, curtains are ripped from hangings, and all these rifles are pointed at the 7 men on the committee, the worst of the Scourers.
So we got the Bertie there working with the G-men.
Were you guys satisfied with this climax?
Oh, I thought it was, the reveal comes in. He's like, he stands up a little taller, changes his voice. All of a sudden, he doesn't have the Irish voice.
He's got a different hat on.
And all of a sudden, all the windows break out because there's guns everywhere.
And the John Williams score swells to its highest point. This is the climax of this story. The only thing for me that was anticlimactic was I wanted more time with these men. I wanted to hear about their emotional state waiting. The waiting is the hardest part. And because this, we're reminded again that this story is not written by Watson. This is not written written by Doyle. This is John Douglas writing this story. We don't get the third-person narrator explaining the emotion of these people, and I missed that.
Well, Steve, maybe if you could stand inside of a wall with a pencil and a piece of paper and see what you can scribble days. Out. That's right. No cigarettes. I mean, come on.
It was a little anticlimactic for me. I had figured out that this man was the undercover Pinkerton a while back, and I think that Doyle had laid it out for us pretty clearly. So this is kind of anticlimactic for me. That's just me.
Well, Tarantino would have taken this to a whole new level.
Oh, all the windows breaking and the curtains being torn is a totally Tarantino scene.
Less blood.
Okay, fine.
So you guys, that's interesting. That I think you guys both had guessed, I'm guessing, that McMurdo was the Pinkerton.
Totally shocked. I
You've been saying it out loud on the show for like 3 days. You figure this out, my friend. You're smart.
So you guys, here's the thing. So in 1875, of course, all of this actually happened. And it wasn't the Scourers. It was a group called the Molly Maguires, right? Who were a secret organization. And officially, they were the Order of Hibernians, which is a national organization. But the Molly Maguires were this chapter that was apparently involved in organized crime. And so the Pinkerton agency was actually paid $100,000, which at that time is a huge amount of money, to go into coal mining country in Pennsylvania and break up this group. And Pinkerton decided to send one single guy, James McParlin. And he was there for 2 years, all right? Which, think about that. For wow. 2 years, and he would send his reports to Pinkerton. Now, Pinkerton had a really, really firm rule that any operative in the field had to report in once a day. McParlin couldn't do that. It simply wasn't possible in this desolate area. And so he reported in like once a month. And when McParlin actually broke open the criminal underworld, there was a lot of controversy. And so people in the U.S. in the late 19th century would have been totally familiar with the Molly Maguires and the infiltration by an undercover operative, because even today, historians can't agree. A number of men were executed, maybe 13, maybe 20. That's the range. And there's like, even historians are like, no, that guy was, that guy wasn't. So there's a lot of debate. There were many, many dime novels written about this. And Pinkerton wrote his own book called The Molly Maguires and the Detectives, in which he gave this really generous reading to McParlin. A lot of people thought McParlin was an agent provocateur, that he went in to the Molly Maguires organization and was kind of baiting people. He said he did not participate in murders and that anytime he could, he warned people and tried to save lives. But not everyone agrees that that was true. McParlin may, in fact, have been quite involved with a number of murders. He was a treasurer. He was a well-educated guy, and he ended up being the bookkeeper and treasurer for the Molly Maguires. And there's a lot of question about involvement. So in this story, when Bertie Edwards explains, and we don't have to read the whole thing, but he explains that, oh, I really tried to save people. He goes through a bunch of things. You know, I was there the night that old man Stanger was beat up, but I stopped Baldwin from killing him. I couldn't save these people, but I did save this person. That's the reason he says all of those things and goes through that in detail, is because readers of the time would have been familiar with the fact that a lot of people thought that James McParlin, the Bertie Edwards of this novel, didn't do nearly enough on the side of Law and Order.
It's a tough spot to be undercover like that, especially for 2 years.
Yeah.
The idea of you need to infiltrate this group in order to get the evidence that you need to close down this violence, but in order to gain their trust, you need to be a part of this group. And that is a narrow ledge to be standing on right there.
This idea of infiltration, I mean, this is part of the history of spying. Mm-hmm. Espionage.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
The HBO show The Wire. The idea of infiltrating a criminal organization to take it down from the inside, to get the right information. All of the secrets that have been kept so closely, to discover those. It's that's a tough job right there.
And of course, Captain Marvin from the Mine Police, he was McMurdo's contact the whole time. And part of the reason that McMurdo was so like openly dismissive of the police on the train was that those guys were actually his friends. And so he was just trying to set up his own credibility.
Mm-hmm. And he did a great job of it. I mean, he was very credible. He rose through the ranks of this organization very quickly.
And he was branded for it. And so two things that I really like about, because I've read the Pinkerton book and several of the Dime novels written on this topic, but two things I really found interesting is he is branded. So I think that's such a great symbol for what undercover work does to a person, right? He's fundamentally changed by his experience of living as a criminal, but for 2 years, and he always would have that brand. And it's super fascinating that Doyle takes that and does something with the brand, in that that brand allows Douglas in the first part of this story to substitute his body for that of someone else's because of this common marking that they share.
All right, so I have a question for you. Who hired this group to do this? Was it the police? Was it the
state? No, it was the railroad. It was the railroad and mining company. And okay. Guys, I'm so glad you asked that, Chip, because Francis Gowan, who was the president of the Pennsylvania Railroad Company and coal mining, who was a super wealthy guy and a lawyer, he actually was the prosecutor of the Molly Maguires. Can you imagine that? Think about the level of corruption that speaks to. Hmm. So the man who hired Pinkerton prosecuted these 13 to 20 guys that were executed. That's where it becomes that question of, was this just a labor versus capital issue? Because capital hires Pinkerton against these miners. Or it's a case of organized crime. Nobody knows. We'll never know, you guys. This is a totally contested issue within American history.
We need to read some books on time travel. We could figure this out.
Time travel solves everything. We should get some time travel books.
The other little point that I always thought really fascinating in the Pinkerton account is that during the 2 years that McFarlane lived in this location, he lost all his hair. He was 30.
Wow.
Yeah.
And wow.
Should we have a moment of silence?
That certainly speaks to the degree of stress that we're talking about, that the physical body exhibits a real symbol of stressful activity in the mind. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. So you know what I mean? Like that detail, that small detail has always really stayed with me. And it's not one that Doyle picked up on, and nor should he have, but it always stayed with me from the Pinkerton account, that when Pinkerton actually finally, he himself goes to Pennsylvania to meet with his agent, and he can't even believe how changed he is. And actually he's lost some weight, but he's also lost all of his hair at age 30.
When we typically look at pictures of presidents from the time that they're elected to when they leave office, whether 4 or 8 years, because they're photographed so much, you get to see this amazing aging process.
Yes.
And they have high stress jobs, they have schedules they have to keep, they have a lot going on, and it is amazing. You can look at those early, this is Abraham Lincoln when he was elected. This is right before he passed away. Wow. Wow. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No doubt.
Totally true. All right. Sorry. That was a bit of a...
we are so glad that you're here to give us that insight, because you have looked at this story from so many different angles over your tenure. I'm happy to sit at your feet and listen. But
let's get into the real answer to this. Listen, if you escape this moment, now you're going off to paradise. Where would you move?
Chicago.
So we get this kind of dime novel ending here where Eddie and her father get the note from Mike Scanlon and they do escape to Chicago.
Of course they do. They got to get a beef, Steve. Or is it a pizza? They never know.
I got a pizza yesterday. I got it. It's upstairs.
And then 10 days later, Eddie and McMurdo / Bertie Edwards do get married. Bodymaster McGinty gets hung. We find out all of these details. 8 other scourers get hung and over 50 are imprisoned. And then some of the imprisoned ones are released after 10 years, at which point they seek revenge on Bertie Edwards. And it's funny because at the beginning, we might have thought that Ted Baldwin hated John Douglas / McMurdo for taking his girl. But it's way deeper than that, right? Mm-hmm. Breaking up his fraternity of criminals. Mm-hmm. So then we go to the chapter ending. Quote, from Chicago, he was chased after 2 attempts so near success that it was sure that the third would get him. From Chicago, he went under a changed name to California. And it was there that the light went for a time out of his life when Eddie Edwards died. Mm. Again, he was nearly killed. And once again, under the name of Douglas, he worked in a lonely canyon, where with an English partner named Barker, he amassed a fortune. At last, there came a warning to him that the bloodhounds were on his track once more, and he cleared, only just in time, for England. And then thence came the John Douglas, who for a second time married a worthy mate and lived for 5 years as a Sussex County gentleman, a life which ended with the strange happenings of which we have heard. So now we hinge it back. We're moving back to the first part of this story. So that would have been the end of chapter 14 for readers of The Strand.
So this last line, a life which ended with the strange happenings of which we have heard. Is Doyle saying that John Douglas's life in Sussex ended on this day, or did we wind up with the fake death of John Douglas here? Is his life on record over? That's an interesting line.
Well, I like that. Although it is, I like that point, but it's also a little bit of a moot point considering the epilogue.
That's right. Epilogue.
So we get to this epilogue, very short return to Sherlock Holmes and Watson looking at this case from their perspective.
Lots of tobacco being smoked. Yeah, maybe some brandy being passed around.
I have to say that I thought the American part of this was very, very good. But if I was a reader in 1915, I would have wanted a bigger epilogue. I wanted a little bit more with Watson and Holmes. It feels so quick.
Is this a Sherlock Holmes story, or is this a really good mystery that has Sherlock Holmes in it?
Mm-hmm. So in the epilogue, it opens, the police trial had passed in which the case of John Douglas was referred to a higher court. So had the quarter sessions at which he was acquitted as having acted in self-defense. Get him out of England at any cost, wrote Holmes to the wife. There are forces here which may be more dangerous than those he has escaped. There is no safety for your husband in England. So John Douglas is acquitted of killing Ted Baldwin, which makes sense because this was a case of self-defense and Baldwin had come into his home with the express motive of killing him. But it's interesting that Holmes realizes this guy is not safe in England.
This is not over by any stretch. So the good news is that John Douglas is safe and gets to live a long life. Then Sherlock Holmes gets a note.
What?
It's a good note, my friends. It looks like a very benign note, but Sherlock knows. I love this description. Then one morning, there came an enigmatic note slipped into our letterbox. Dear me, Mr. Holmes, dear me, said this singular epistle. There was neither superscription nor signature. I laughed at the quaint message, but Holmes showed unwonted seriousness. Mm-hmm. Can you imagine writing that note? Dear me, Mr. Holmes, dear me.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a message in there from the criminal mastermind that we remember from part one was mentioned, Professor Moriarty.
And you guys, I know you didn't see this coming, but John Douglas does not, in fact, live a long and happy life with his second wife.
What?
He dies on his way to South Africa.
On a ship. Of course. So, Doyle.
So we have a British ending. We don't have an American ending.
This is, you're right. 100%. This is Doyle's British ending to this American tale. He gets on a ship to South Africa and does not make the journey complete because he dies.
For the American audience, he lived happily ever after.
Exactly. And Cecil Barker comes to Baker Street to tell Holmes and Watson. And he says, oh, it's so sad. He was lost at sea. No, no, my good sir, said Holmes. There is a master hand here. It is no case of sawed-off shotguns and clumsy six-shooters. You can tell an old master by the sweep of his brush. I can tell a Moriarty when I see one. This crime is from London, not from America. Whew. That is quite a statement, don't you think?
Yes. That is Doyle saying, yes, I wrote a dime novel. There, I can write a dime novel. He even mentioned that this was a dime novel in the text here. And then he goes on to go ahead and make this a better story to make it a British story.
Exactly.
Take that, Americans.
That's right. British flag raising
He's drinking tea. He's got toast and butter. He's like, look at this.
Oh, the Queen is on the telly.
Which brings us to the chapter ending. Barker beat his head with his clenched fist in his impotent anger. Do not tell me that we have to sit down under all this. Do you say that no one can ever get level with this King Devil? No, I don't say that, said Holmes, and his eyes seem to be looking far into the future. I don't say that he can't be beat, but you must give me time. You must give me time. We all sat in silence for some minutes while those fateful eyes still strained to pierce the veil. The end.
So once again, Watson does what he does best.
Writes all this down and says nothing.
Well, he's just there as Holmes contemplates. There.
Piece of furniture.
And he watches Sherlock's eyes. Mm-hmm. Always tells us about Sherlock's eyes. And in this case, Sherlock is looking into the future. And you guys, it's a future that we know, right?
Mm-hmm.
This is written in 1915. But in fact, we know that Sherlock kills Moriarty. So we know that Sherlock will, in fact, get revenge for Douglas and will, in fact, rid London of this horrible criminal mastermind. But Holmes doesn't know it yet. And as he looks into that future, his fateful eyes trying to pierce the veil, he has no idea he's going to succeed, but we do. There's something really satisfying about that.
There's something very prequely about that, though.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Totally.
There's some honey being made, beekeeping, you know, all the things that are going on in the future.
And here's the thing that I'm going to say out loud, is all I can imagine is Benedict Cumberbatch holding up one finger, sitting, looking into the future, and there's only one way that this can end, and this is the way.
Yes.
It all comes together. The Marvel Universe, the Star Wars Universe, it's all in here.
So you guys, I just wanted to end with one final question for you. What do you think it means that McMurdo / Edward / Douglas is killed at the end? Like, come on. Why kill this guy? Why not let him have his happy ending?
It's so British.
It's so British. He's on a ship. I mean, and this is so Doyle. We have seen this. We've seen this ending. Name a happy ending. Is there a short story that we've read where the couple goes off and lives happily ever after? Yes, that exists.
There are a few.
But for the majority of Doyle's writing, this guy doesn't last long.
But I think that usually in Doyle, it's a punishment, right?
This is an interesting choice. I'm sorry. You brought the question up, and I do think this is an interesting choice. There was no reason why we had to show this guy get his comeuppance for infiltrating this group and destroying this piece. But you know what? Maybe it's to play up Moriarty. You know, we read it. We knew who he is. We know he's got his fingers not in London, but now he's got them in America too. He's a worldwide threat now.
But he's not used again. There is no more Moriarty work. This is the last we hear of Moriarty chronologically. You know, the prequel status of this story. It's frustrating to me. Prequels.
So I will say, like, from my perspective, I love this ending because I think it is a punishment, just as Chip was just thinking. I think it's a punishment for being a very morally sketchy detective, the American kind, right? Like, Sherlock.
Wow, Doyle, thanks.
Well, you know, this is written in 1914-15. Think about what's happening in World War I right now.
Yeah, we're building it up, yes.
Right? I mean, there's a lot of tension between America and Britain at this time in terms of when is America going to join the war, right? And I feel like Doyle is really setting up not only the American detective versus the British detective. Like, this is how we do things in the UK, right? This is like Sherlock Holmes works in this way. And look at McMurdo. He's so sketchy because we do see McMurdo doing some pretty sketchy business. And then there's also the notion of what is American detective fiction versus British detective fiction, right? Wow. And so look at a dime novel versus a Sherlock Holmes story. So I think there's a certain comparison going on here between not only American crime and detection, but also American crime and detective fiction being compared to Doyle's own brand, which by 1915, he knows how much of an influence he's going to have on the genre. I mean, Sherlock Holmes, really, he didn't create the drawing room detective, but boy, did he ever propel it into prominence.
Well, and we're still talking about it, you know, over 100 years later.
Exactly.
So obviously, in fact, I'm not even sure if I could name a dime store author who is on any level that Doyle is on.
You definitely couldn't.
Thank you very much.
No, there aren't any.
There you go.
And is there still a discussion about the distrust of the police and the undercover nature of detection here? Is that still a part of the punishment?
I think so.
Yeah. I think the distrust of the police is something that we still struggle with. And
There's so much more going on here. There's a rural setting. This is a new town. There was a gang that was kind of running things.
There's capitalism versus labor. There's so many things going on here.
Capitalism. Okay. More along the lines, there's a business being run who's got basically a gang element into it. Were they working to the business's interests as far as organizing their labor, or were they working against it, or a little bit of both? It could be any number of things going on.
Mm-hmm. There's all of that. This is, there's a lot to discuss in this. There's a lot of papers to be written about this, Pam.
Oh, yes. And so I am so thrilled that we've read the four novels alongside the short stories, because I do think Doyle really took the opportunity, really in all four of the novels, each of which was quite different from one another, right?
Mm-hmm.
He really took the opportunity to delve deep into some of those topics that he just touched on in the short stories.
Agreed. I've said it four times, but I'll say it again. I wish that there was another novel that he was publishing under the Sherlock Holmes story, because he's really reached the height of his ability to write at this point. The episodic nature, publishing monthly, worked really well for this writing. So we've reached the end. This is the end of the canon. We have read and discussed every word that Arthur Conan Doyle ever wrote about Sherlock Holmes. How about that?
Well, we haven't discussed everything. We're going to come back tomorrow.
Yeah, tomorrow we're going to have to wrap this up. We have two questions that we would love to hear from you. The first question, what is your favorite of these stories? What we're going to rank all 60 stories, and where do they fall for you? What's your favorite? And then the second question is, what makes a Sherlock Holmes story a Sherlock Holmes story? What are those tropes, those things that we've seen over and over again in the canon that make these stories what they are? We would love to hear from you. Give us a call or a text, send us an email, follow our hashtag TMS Sherlock Holmes for all of that discussion, and make sure you go to our dedicated Sherlock Holmes website, sandwiches@irregularhours.com, for a list of all of these discussions over the entire canon of Sherlock Holmes stories. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
I'm Chip Hasenflaw.
And I'm Pam Bedore, finally leaving the Valley of Fear. What I wanna think